You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
short-term geopolitical considerations and national interests have repeatedly taken precedence over intolerable human suffering. I firmly believe that greater responsiveness by this council would have saved hundreds of thousands of lives.
Outgoing UN Human Rights Chief Navi Pillay throws the Security Council an elbow as she prepares to leave the UN after 6 years in office. I'll be joined by Tim Marshall and George Brock. We'll be discussing that and more of the day's key stories from around the world. We'll be looking at, among other things, the murder of American journalist James Foley and asking whether news organisations facing increasingly squeezed budgets are exploiting ambitious, underprotected, inexperienced freelancers. A little later in the programme, we'll bring you another instalment of our Summer Read series.
Spies in South Korea, British intelligence agents, beautiful Korean women, and North Koreans. A heady mixture.
And before the end of the programme...
Yes?
Professor Norman, my name's Lucy. I just read all your research on the human brain. It's a little rudimentary, but you're on the right track.
We'll bring you our weekly review of the latest film releases today, assisted by Tim Robey of The Telegraph. All that coming up here on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24. An action-packed hour ahead, as always, but ahead of all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the latest world news.
Ukraine has declared today that Russia has launched a direct invasion of its territory after Moscow sent a convoy of aid lorries across the border into eastern Ukraine, where pro-Russian rebels are fighting government forces. Moscow, which has thousands of troops close to the Russian side of the border, warned against any attempt to disrupt the convoy. It said was a purely humanitarian operation, but it didn't say what action it might take if Kiev's military intervened. Nigeria has confirmed two new cases of Ebola, both in patients who caught the disease from people who were primary contacts of the Liberian man who first brought it to Lagos. The total number of cases of the Ebola virus disease so far recorded in Nigeria is 14. Meanwhile, US medical experts say no effective therapy for the Ebola virus has been discovered so far, despite the release of two infected Americans from hospital. Dr. Anthony Fauci is the director of the National Institute of Allergic and Infectious Diseases at the National Institute of Health.
When you're talking about ZMapp, ZMapp is a therapy for people who are already infected, and it is a protein that the body generally makes, but in this case is artificially made and manufactured, that has the purpose and the effect of blocking the virus in the body. That's totally different than preventing infection in the first place. Once a treatment, and the other one is a vaccine.
At least 191,369 people have been killed in Syria's conflict up to the end of April, more than double the figure documented a year ago, and probably still an underestimate, the United Nations Human Rights Office said today. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, said that the UN report, based on data from four groups and the government that were cross-checked, reflects a reality of killing and torture, while the civil war has, as she put it, dropped off the international radar. US military leaders said the sophistication, wealth and military might of Islamic State militants posed a major threat to the United States that may surpass that from Al-Qaeda. General Martin Dempsey, chairman of the US Joint Chiefs of Staff, said the group in Iraq could pose a direct threat to Western countries through the return of European or US nationals to their home countries after having fought in Syria or Iraq.
Our efforts in Iraq have included, to date, seven humanitarian airdrop missions delivering 636 bundles of food, water, and medical supplies. More than 60 intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance sorties daily, each day. And to date, 89 targeted airstrikes conducted by United States Air Force and United States Navy aircraft. These airstrikes have protected U.S. persons and facilities and helped prevent humanitarian crisis.
And finally, in the United States, California diners can now legally enjoy a meal on a restaurant patio with their dogs in tow, under a law signed by the governor, Jerry Brown, that eliminates health code regulations banning restaurant owners from allowing pooches on the premises. Starting next year, California canines will be allowed to dine al fresco if they are wearing leads. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. We will be back right after this.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Hong Kong, Zurich, London,
Londres. Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
From London,
London, London,
Canada.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. It's 18:06 here in London, 13:06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio, I have Tim Marshall, diplomatic editor for UK's Sky News, and George Brock, head of the School of Journalism at City University here in London. We will start tonight with the UN, which is currently the recipient of slightly more than usual demands that something be done, whatever that something may be, and whoever may actually have to do it. The UN's own outgoing High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, has added her voice to the heckling, suggesting that greater responsiveness by the UN Security Council to various crises could have saved hundreds of thousands of lives. Tim, I'll ask you first, does she have a point here?
She has a point, but it's impossible to talk about the UN without stating platitudes and the blindingly obvious, which is what she's done. It is the sum of its parts. It is realpolitik at the highest level. And mere considerations such as human rights abuses are not going to get in the way of realpolitik.
The bleeding obvious, as you're stating there, Tim, and I'll put this to you, George, the problem here, is, especially with current crises, the Ukraine, for example, which we will get to shortly, when a permanent member of the UN Security Council is directly involved, there is absolutely no chance of the UN doing anything, is there?
No, many institutions suffer from architecture that was designed in a completely different age for completely different purposes. When they set the UN up, they said you've got the Security Council and there are going to be these five members who can effectively veto or stop anything they like. They weren't imagining modern circumstances in which they were going to be called to do all these hundreds and dozens of things. They didn't foresee the end of the Cold War and about a dozen other things. How could they have? So they're now stuck with a system which is not particularly fit for purpose. But whatever system they had, they would have these kinds of problems. Big multilateral organisations have lowest common denominator problems. They're always afflicted by them.
She suggested, trying to be constructive, in fairness to Ms. Pillay, that the UNSC come up with what she called a rapid, flexible and resource-efficient human rights monitoring missions. Tim, of what effect would that be against the Islamic State, for example?
Very little. And also, she has been a career diplomat, mostly in human rights. And you take your hat off to people, especially at the UN, that are going out there and doing fantastic work. I'm not critical of the UN per se, but within it, there are the deep politics. And she alluded to it, but she's part of the deep politics. And an example of that is that the UN Human Rights Council used to be chaired by Libya at the time that Colonel Gaddafi was in charge of Libya.
The UN Human Rights Council is a popular punchline and not without reason. I believe its current members include such sunlit uplands as Eritrea and Saudi Arabia.
Exactly. So she's right to have a pop at the UN and the Security Council, but even within her own Human Rights Council, there are exactly the same type of divisions where someone will block someone else, someone will gather a number of nations around them to outvote other nations, even when it's people's lives at stake, because I'm not arguing for this, I'm just repeating it is realpolitik.
George, there are two permanent members of the UN Security Council, France and the UK, currently allegedly preparing a resolution on Gaza. Given the realpolitik in this case, as Tim mentioned, which is the almost certain likelihood of a US veto, is there any point?
Very little indeed. A lot of what they're doing at the UN is, I'm afraid, ritual. rather like Ms. Pillay, who you were quoting just now. You said that she suggested something rapid, flexible, and resource efficient. When did you last hear anybody use those words about the UN?
Those of us that have seen the UN in action in the field with the best will in the world, are not generally the adjectives
the old,
we reach for.
The old Kissinger thing about Europe, you know, which number do you ring when you want to ring Europe? You try ringing the United Nations on a Saturday, and you will only find the empty halls ringing with the phone number that you're trying to get hold of, because there won't be anybody there.
I have been in that position many times myself. We'll move along to a crisis which directly kind of illustrates the problem, which is a crisis in which one UNSC permanent member is not merely a player but a provocateur, and that's the one in Ukraine. Earlier today, more than 100 Russian humanitarian aid, and I invite listeners to imagine the inverted commas for themselves, trucks crossed the border into Ukraine without permission from Kiev. This is somewhat less subtle than making a gift of a large wooden horse. President Poroshenko has called it a flagrant violation of international law. And just as we came to air, NATO was claiming that artillery, Russian artillery, that is, has been deployed inside Ukraine's borders. Tim, I'll ask you first. This sounds a bit invade-y, doesn't it?
It does. The test is yet to come. The Ukrainians, I mean, they haven't turned a blind eye. They're crying blue murder over it. But the test comes. The convoy at the moment is in territory controlled by Russian-backed rebel forces. To get to Luhansk, there is a corridor of several tens of miles, which they don't control. So they're going to have to cross that land and come up against what will be the front line, but it will be the front line of the Ukrainian forces. And at that point, they're not going to let them through. So what is going to happen? So that test has yet to come. The Russians are making their point, that we should have an influence here, and everybody else is making the opposite point. And you said in the introduction that one of the UN Security Council members is a player. I would argue four are, because the Americans, the French, and the British have done their bit to peel Ukraine away from Russian influence. And again, I'm not arguing the rights and wrongs of either position, but there's four players in this.
George, the Russian artillery is presumably not being deployed in order to launch tins of beans into besieged Luhansk. Has Russia already learnt that it can do as it pleases in Ukraine?
No, I don't think it has, actually. I think what they're engaged in is something that you would really just call grandmother's footsteps. If they do anything too obvious, too direct, too brutal, they will cause a firestorm that in the end they're going to regret. And they're very, very long practiced at this kind of doing something that doesn't really appear to be something. Now, okay, maybe not every single one of those lorries is full of pineapple chunks, and then maybe there are guns or weapons or ordnance or something inside them. It would take the Ukrainians an amazingly long time to search them thoroughly, which is one of the things on which the Russians are presumably counting when they get stopped.
There is apparently 100 trucks across the border and another couple of hundred waiting.
But the Red Cross has disassociated itself.
They're not actually declaring war on this area. I mean, they're actually trying to do something without appearing to do it. And there are difficulties in doing that. You can't directly control things. So they kind of poke, you know, they poke the anthill without wanting to get completely covered in ants.
And then they aren't. I mean, I agree completely with that. I think Putin is a master of doing this. I mean, he's got away with Ukraine. He's got away with this so far. Excuse me, with Crimea. I also think he's a student of history. He knows that the Soviet Union overstretched. And that's one of the reasons it collapsed. And I don't think he is going to overstretch. Overstretching is going to a NATO country. Overstretching is going into the Baltic states. I mean, I'm not Moldova, places like that. He's going to play. Georgia, he's going to play. But he's not going to play with a NATO country, because I think he realizes at that point enough people will say, you have crossed that line.
Well, I mean, Article 5 makes it fairly clear what line he would have crossed in that circumstance. But in what way does it suit Vladimir Putin to keep, and I'll put this to you first, Tim, to keep Ukraine in a state of, long-term semi-war? How does this, I mean, you know, MH17 surely taught him something about how events can escalate beyond anybody's control.
Yeah, that was playing with fire, I agree. He does it because of the same reason that every other Russian leader has always done it. As far as they're concerned, Ukraine is simply a buffer zone between it and the barbarians that keep invading it. I mean, that's their view. The Finns invaded from that direction, the Poles, the Swedes, the French in 1812, the British before that in the Crimean War, the Germans twice in the 20th century. They all came across that flat ground. So Russia will do anything it can. And if it can't control all of it, it will stir it and mess it about to make sure that Kiev looks in two directions at the same time.
George, do you think that's where Moscow is going with this? Is it sort of accumulated historical paranoia about what lies to the West?
Yeah, and that paranoia isn't just in the mind of Vladimir Putin either. I wouldn't concentrate too hard on Putin here. When he stood in front of the Duma and said, Crimea is now ours, his ratings went up 15%.
Yeah.
There's real popular pressure on him to do this. Real popular pressure.
Well, on that happy note, we will take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with George Brock and Tim Marshall. When we return, we'll be looking at the murder of James Foley and looking at what that tells us about hostage taking as a weapon of modern war and about the realities of conflict coverage.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau. The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House. And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's coming up for 1817 in London. Still with me is Tim Marshall, diplomatic editor of Sky News, and George Brock, head of journalism at City University. Now, this week's murder of the American journalist James Foley by the pious thugs of the Islamic State shocked everybody, but it had a particular charge for Foley's fellow reporters. What happened to Foley after nearly 2 years of captivity in Syria was pretty much the sum of nightmares for any journalist who decides to go to war. We'll come to the question of whether it's ever worth it shortly. But first, the coverage IS were able to generate with their slickly shot snuff film illustrated the enduring potence of hostage taking. George, I'll ask you first. It's since been reported that the Islamic State wanted £80 million in return for James Foley. Should someone have paid it?
No, I don't really think they should have. There have obviously been examples of countries, much smaller countries, whose nationals are less attractive than American captives are. It looks like they've paid money, and in the case of one British hostage, the British government released somebody in order to get an IT technician called Peter Moore out of the hands of a different group, not IS, in fact. But I think that if America paid $132 million, or anywhere approaching it, they would find the bill increased very, very rapidly. And I don't think it would help either solve or stop the problem.
Is it just a question of the price, though? Because obviously, to make a reductio ad absurdum counterexample, if somebody had announced that they wanted $1,000 ransom for an American hostage, then obviously someone would just go, well, yeah, sure. Is it just a question of price, or are there other factors?
There are other factors, but and the argument, as you realise, is absurd because they wouldn't, and therefore it's hypothetical. And I'm afraid we've just heard the classic argument, and I concur with it. Obviously, if you're in that situation, you might change your mind and think, "Well, actually, I do now agree with paying ransoms to get me out of there." But from where we sit, I think most people understand that argument because, yes, you might well save that life, but you will probably cost other lives in the future. I mean, these are hard life and genuine life and death decisions which governments make. And the British policy is not to pay. I believe the American policy is not to pay. My heart does go out to the Foley family. It's about him, not me. But I was in Syria about a year and a half ago, and a group of villagers that were with opposition forces were quite friendly. And then some guys with beards turned up and it became less friendly. And they said, "Oh, you can't leave." And all these things were flashing through my head. Now, we did manage to leave. It is increasingly a danger, and it is something I think all those reporters that go out there do have in the back of their minds. It's one of the reasons I don't go anymore. I've taken a step back to try to do wider diplomacy and not frontline reporting, and that is one of the reasons why.
George, do hostages, especially journalist hostages, Western journalist hostages, do they have a value beyond the monetary? Is it just money, or is it the attention that people are after? At which point, I guess we need to ask, how does one address that weird symbiotic relationship which exists between any terrorism and the media?
I think they have some value because their organizations, in certain circumstances, will publicize what is going on. Now, I stress in certain circumstances. In fact, in the case of most of the hostages in Syria, virtually nobody had heard of James Foley outside his own organization until he was killed. There's been a
real change in thinking about that.
There's been
that,
a large
though,
change
there?
In thinking because there has been a change in the behavior of the kidnappers, largely. And they're a very much ruthless organization than many of their kinds of predecessors. But don't forget that although we're focused on journalists here, they do pick up aid workers too. They kidnapped another four people on Wednesday, or we knew about it on Wednesday. I'm fairly sure that they aren't journalists. I think they're aid workers.
There is a family aspect to the family of journalism to this.
Yeah.
Who remembers the poor unfortunate Ken Bigley, who I think was one of the first Brits, his head was removed in Iraq. And if you follow news very closely, you'll think, oh yeah, I do remember Ken Bigley. But about a lot more people remember Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter who was beheaded in Pakistan. And more will also remember James Foley. And that is because it's so raw for journalists that those stories do recirculate more and more often than they do for aid workers, who, of course, are not less important.
And of course, without belittling the horror that befell James Foley, he was only one of many hundreds of people to die violently in Syria this week.
But it's emblematic, though, isn't it?
Indeed. But does that make Western reporters especially valuable as targets?
Yeah, it makes them pretty valuable. But I think if you think as the Islamic State does, almost any American is valuable. It's nationality, probably more than occupation.
Yeah. What advice, we mentioned briefly there that the thinking about this has changed. Certainly I was generally taught that if you get into strife of that sort, the thing to do is make as much fuss as possible. We saw this with the people who were held for years in Lebanon by Hezbollah and similar organisations. It was all about, you know, maintain awareness, keep the story alive. What is the thinking on that now, Tim? What are journalists and organisations taught about how to respond to a situation like this?
I was Free John McCarthy campaign. I was living in Paris and I actually chaired the Paris branch of that. And the thinking then was, yeah, make a lot of noise, keep them in the public eye. And the French, there was three French journalists, Jean-Paul Kaufmann and two others, and every single night their television station started the news with their names. And this went on for years. The thinking of the Foreign Office at the time was keep as quiet about it as possible, let us work behind the scenes. And the Foreign Office still tends to take that view. But what has happened in the past 20 years since the John McCarthy, Terry Waite case, is that on individual cases, families have got a template to go back and look at. What was that campaign like? How successful was that? Did that cause any harm? And now families and organisations do look at each situation as it is and sometimes say to the Foreign Office, no, we disagree with what you're saying.
Well, Foley's situation, to sort of take a wider view of this, was exacerbated by the fact that he was not working for a major media organisation, although, as the example of three Al Jazeera journalists currently held hostage by Egypt demonstrates, even that doesn't always help. James Foley went to war as a freelance, as many ambitious reporters do, accepting the risks that come with that choice. But should major media outlets exploit that enthusiasm, especially when they're too cheap to cover the same stories themselves? George, is it right for a major mainstream, well-resourced media organisation, a proper grown-up newspaper, to buy or commission things from people working in the field with no protection, no insurance, no training, no experience?
It would be much better if they didn't and they had time to carefully advise all of the people who might be working for them. But I think it would be extremely hard to write kind of guidelines for every single media organization in the world, which would eliminate that, if you see what I mean. Don't forget that freelancers do things by their own choice. We should remember that most of the people who've died in Syria are Syrians. You don't have any choice about this. Journalists choose to go places. They do choose to put themselves at risk. Now, you can lower those risks by having people trained, advising them, looking after them, and doing all the things that major media organizations will do. But I don't think that we can abolish freelance journalism, if you see what I mean. And you can't stop freelance journalists going to risky places. It will happen.
Tim, does a major news outlet owe anything to people contributing from the field on off their own bat?
Well, a platitude is to say a sense of concern, yes, and they do get that. But, it's this really tricky area. And I think things have changed in the last few years. I think more attention is paid to the freelancers, and they are given some assistance. But the duty of care of a news organization is to the people that work for it. Once you're outside of that duty of care, you are making choices on your own, and these guys have made their choices. If you were to bring them in, then you'd say, right, we are going to supply you, the freelance, with this camera, this bulletproof vest, this training on the four-day courses that they sometimes go on, this medical pack, this insurance. And why should they do that for people that are not employed by them? There is this market out there, but it's a really difficult, and it is a moral question. And there are relationships that do grow up. And when there are relationships that are closer, there is more assistance given. But I think it's impossible for the major news organizations. I mean, which ones would they choose and which ones wouldn't they choose? And the ones that aren't somewhat helped, who are out there completely on their own, if they get a picture of the moment of Mr. Gaddafi's demise, oh, well, we're not going to buy that picture because we never gave him a flak jacket. I mean, it's just fraught, and I don't really see a way around it other than trying to work together. The Frontline Club in London does quite a lot of work on this front.
And indeed, we should mention organisations like the Rory Peck Trust who do terrific work on this. But George, what does it mean for the journalism, say a story like Syria, which is clearly an important story, which a lot of major news organisations won't send people to cover because it's incredibly dangerous, and it's obviously incredibly dangerous. The insurance, I'm sure, is preposterously expensive. The risks are horrific, which means that all the first-hand coverage we get is from people who are being paid extremely badly, maybe very young, very inexperienced. How does that shape our view of what's going on in a place like that?
Well, periodically you have stories that are so dangerous that the information will be incomplete, fragmentary, and extremely difficult to verify for a whole series of reasons. You know, at one point reporting from Zimbabwe was really hard. The authorities tried extremely hard to keep particularly British journalists out. So news came out of Zimbabwe in odd little scraps and fragments, and it was probably a bit distorted as a result for a time. Well, Syria is just a larger example of the same thing. You will always have situations where the information is just extremely hard and difficult to get at. You know, there's lots we don't know about North Korea, you know, and so on. There are gaps. There are always gaps in that kind of knowledge.
The risk, I guess, then what we need to talk about then is the risk of filling those gaps. And Tim, you mentioned earlier that you've taken a step back from the front line, as it were, but you have covered a lot of stories in fairly rickety places. If somebody came to you as an aspiring freelance, and I'm sure they do, and announced a plan to go to Syria to make a name for themselves, would you counsel them that, yeah, sure, that's a sensible decision and the risks are totally worth it?
No, I would counsel them the opposite. But I wouldn't say, I mean, I can't make the decision for them, and I wouldn't say do, you know, I would advise them not to go unless you do A, B, and C. And those A, B, and C's might be, you might have to go and pay for yourself to go on one of these 3 or 4 day courses to learn stuff. Do you, and I would talk them through it. Do you know what to do when you're approaching a checkpoint? You know, do you know to turn the radio off, to turn the windows down, to take your sunglasses off? You know, do you know that? And those are 3 examples of 100. Do you know all this stuff? Well, you don't know it, right? So why are you going? Why don't you try and learn this somewhere? Why don't you approach it more gradually? And I would advise against going. I remember I was in Baghdad in 2003 after the statue went down, and there was a young photographer, never doesn't seem to have taken a photograph in his life, poor lad. And he was about 22, he was a student. He came out, got a flight, arrived in Baghdad, stayed in the hotel where the journalists were, went out and got shot in the head in a crowd the following day. I mean, it could have happened to anyone. But he doesn't know when crowds are turning. He just didn't know, poor guy. And that, no, people should not go and try and make a name for themselves. Take it slowly. The name will come if you're good enough.
George, is it worth it?
No, of course it's not worth it. I mean, it's not worth injury, and it's not worth death. I do a lot of work with the International News Safety Institute, and everybody can concentrate on training. And to some extent, even equipment, but there is no substitute for experience and wisdom which people acquire slowly. That does not guarantee that people stay alive.
It does
not.
But
it does improve their odds.
We will have to leave it there. Tim Marshall, diplomatic editor for Sky News. George Brock, head of the School of Journalism at City University. Thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Phonote London. Dit is Monocle 24.
런던으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
位于 伦敦, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still coming up in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be speaking to our man in Barcelona. We'll meet the photographer Laura El Tantawi, and we'll catch up with the latest cinema releases. But before all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the world news.
Thank you very much. Nigeria has confirmed two new cases of Ebola, both in patients who caught the disease from people who were primary contacts of the Liberian man who first brought it to Lagos. The total number of cases of the Ebola virus so far recorded in Nigeria is now 14. Ukraine has declared today that Russia has launched a direct invasion of its territory after Moscow sent a convoy of aid lorries across the border into eastern Ukraine, where pro-Russian rebels are fighting government forces. At least 191,369 people have been killed in Syria's conflict up to the end of April, more than double the figure documented a year ago, and probably still an underestimate according to the United Nations Human Rights Office, which spoke today. And the US military leaders have said today that the sophistication, wealth and military might of Islamic State militants pose a major threat to the United States that may surpass that from Al-Qaeda. And that's latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. Welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. It is 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London, 14:32 in Rio. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today, it is the turn of Barcelona, from where I'm joined by Liam Aldous. Liam, welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you? We're back.
I'm very, very well. First of all, I want to talk about something of an own goal by the president of Catalonia.
Yeah, so there's a bit of a political scandal. I flew into Barcelona yesterday, and this scandal or storm has been brewing for about a month when the ex-premier of Catalonia, a man who served for 34 years and is known as kind of the founder of the independence movement, Jordi Pujol, actually admitted to having an offshore bank account and undeclared funds. Now, some people might ask why he's done this in the lead up to a much-wanted referendum on independence in November. And it's basically because his sons are being investigated for corruption charges, and he's come out in their defense saying that the money, the family money, is actually from an inheritance, and that he is sorry that he never declared this fortune of rumored to be about 4 million euros, but it's not from their shady dealings, it's just from an inheritance. So this has been massively damaging to the independence movement because he's the father of the independence movement.
So he's flying the money was only resting in my account defense. How is this playing with people?
Well, it's been quite distressing for a lot of people. Some people, though, in other parts of Spain may be celebrating because the typical catch cry of the people crying for independence is that Madrid is robbing Catalonia. And now it comes out that the man who is the leading light of Catalan nationalism has also been robbing Catalonia. So there's a lot of kind of hypocrisy and absurdity in this whole issue. The fact that the foundation, the eponymous foundation of Jordi Pujol, actually specializes in ethics. So there's lots to deal with here as a journalist. But there's been another report as well that actually leaked by the Spanish tax department, which says that Pujol's fortune is actually estimated at about 1.8 billion euros. So that would actually make him the unofficial eighth richest man in Spain.
He could just about buy Catalonia with that. We should move along to whatever the Spanish for gerrymandering is. The Prime Minister has some interesting ideas about electoral law.
Yes, this is another scandal. We should move back to Madrid now. There's another political storm brewing over there as well. The fact that Conservative Prime Minister Rajoy has basically announced that he's going to go ahead with changes to the electoral law, and this will change the way the game is played. So some of the critics are saying he's changing the rules halfway through the game, basically how mayors and local government is elected. And there's local government elections next May, and basically the Conservative Party has a lot of these, a lot of its candidates in city councils across the country, but it's took a real blow in European elections. The national vote was an average of about 44% before the European elections. After the European elections, it was about 26%. So then the rules that he's changing will basically allow many of these mayors to stay in City Hall without actually achieving an absolute majority. So people are criticising this, and there's no consensus. No other party is supporting this, which will make it the first time in Spanish democratic history that a serious law of this kind has changed without a parliamentary consensus.
And finally, Liam, where you are now, the great city of Barcelona has discovered, like Amsterdam before it, that liberalising your cannabis laws does make you rather a jackass magnet.
Yeah, that's true. This is a big debate in Barcelona at the moment. Not only the cannabis clubs, which you mentioned, which have exploded in recent years. There's about 400 clubs in Catalonia as a whole, and about 165,000 members can basically enjoy their membership entails them to buy marijuana unfettered by laws. There's a very interesting law in Spain which says that if you set up a clubhouse in your house, you basically can do whatever you like. I mean, within limits, of course. But one of these things that they can do is sell cannabis. So because there's been a few issues with selling to tourists, and the city council is worried that they're getting a bad name, people are calling them the Holland of the South, they're cracking down. And they recently shut down 100 of these clubs because people were going out into the street from these clubs and luring tourists in with flyers and installing PlayStations inside and really making it quite attractive. So they're really trying to crack down on this cannabis trade.
And what effect is this having on Barcelona's nightlife?
Well, there was a report yesterday of some crazy naked Italian tourists running around La Barceloneta, and this wasn't linked to the cannabis club, but it feeds into this general issue of the cheap tourism that's kind of taking over Barcelona, and some residents were worried that in Barceloneta a lot of people are renting out their houses via Airbnb and privately to these cheap tourists, and they're basically making the area unlivable. And some residents campaigned and went to a real estate office and did an escrache, which is a big noisy protest outside to protest this movement. So this is an ongoing issue in Barcelona, and the cannabis clubs is just a part of that puzzle.
Liam Aldous in Barcelona, thank you very much for joining us. Stay tuned. You're listening to Monocle 24. We'll be meeting the photographer Laura Altantawi next.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. It's just gone 18:39 in London, which will be 20:39 in Cairo. Now, back in 2005, it might have seemed unlikely that Egypt, relatively stable as it appeared, would serve as the locus of one of the most transformative events of the 21st century. It turned out to have been a pretty good time to have started work on a long-term photographic project exploring Egyptian identity. The second half of the near decade since has been giddingly eventful for Egypt and the region surrounding it, and pointing a camera at much of it has been Laura Altantawi for a project called In the Shadow of the Pyramids, exhibiting next month in Oxford and Tampere and available as a book at some point in the future. Laura joins me now. Has this project become massively different from what you imagined it would be in 2005?
Yes, actually, because when it first started, it was really more about me discovering myself and my country. And I think the way it's evolved, naturally, because of the political events, it's become broader than that. And I think the book is going to illustrate that.
Well, as you explain, you started out trying to understand your own identity by going and taking pictures of Egypt. How did the project change? Had it started to change before the Arab Spring, or did you realize that there was something in the air before then?
Well, I think I felt it in the air before then, because even when I went back in 2005, I could still sense at that stage that there was something brewing. I think as an Egyptian, as generally, as Egyptians, we always knew something politically had to happen. We just didn't know when. But for me, the project really was more of an intersection of my personal identity clash, which is between East and West. So initially, this is really what I wanted to explore. I don't know if it's really that anymore, but part of the book is going to be that. But I think it's become much broader.
That clash you mentioned between East and West, to what extent do you think it was manifested in the 2011 revolution especially? Because it struck me, and I don't know Egypt well, I'd been there once in 2010, I think, but it did strike me that a lot of the media coverage focused on the Tahrir Square revolutionaries, all these kind of middle-class, educated, secular, good-looking kids who spoke English and had a Western outlook, and kind of forgot that they're not Egypt.
Yeah, that's true. I think the focus was that. But, I mean, for me, a lot of my work from the revolution does come out of Tahrir Square. But for me, the motivation was that I really felt like it became a microcosm of the Egypt that I wanted Egypt to be. So I felt that in the faces, in the energy, even in the conversations that people were engaging in. But yeah, I know what you mean in terms of the foreign media, which I can't criticize. I think it's always good to have a foreign as well as a local perspective. And I hope my work brings that local perspective to a certain extent.
You mentioned that you use the phrase the faces of the revolution, which is a section of the project which appears on your website, which I think, am I right in saying, is in the shadow of the pyramids.com. And the faces of the revolution is exactly that. It's a lot of very intense, very close-up portraits. Where did you find those faces?
In the square. I spent a lot of time looking and trying to find the emotion that I was personally feeling. And when I talk about that particular series, for me, I feel like it's actually the most important series in that work because of that, because it is about the faces. And for me, the story of Egypt and the story of the revolution is about the people and the emotion that people were bringing to the square and the stories as well. And I feel like a lot of these faces were actually saying my personal emotion as well. So they're self-portraits as well as pictures of the people in the square.
How frequently since 2011, how much time have you spent traveling back and forth in Egypt? How much time have you spent there?
At some point, I've been going there almost on a monthly basis or every 2 months. I would say since August of 2013 and the events in that month, which was the clearing of Rabaa and a lot of the political turmoil, I actually try to avoid going back to Egypt. I think going back from the revolution and that really positive energy to a lot of what I'm sensing right now, I just don't feel like it's my story anymore, or there's nothing for me to express anymore with the certain level of sentiment and emotion that I had. I don't have that for Egypt at this point anymore. It might take some time for me to recover, maybe not. And I think that's why I felt like my book was done. I had said everything I wanted to say, expressed all the emotions I had, and I didn't have anything else.
Do you kind of feel then that Egypt has trudged in this somewhat baleful circle from dictatorship via, you know, revolution, upheaval, election, coup, back to dictatorship? Do you feel it's basically the same Egypt it was in 2011?
For sure. I mean, even looking at the way local media is operating, the way the language people are using to speak, we're back to being very intolerant. There's no tolerance for a different opinion. And for me, I feel people always tell me when I say this that I'm being very negative and that it takes time for revolution to actually become what people wanted it to be. And I completely agree with that. But I do feel like we're starting from the wrong base. We're not even starting from the right place to say we're developing a good democracy. Some good things are going to happen with Sisi, but I don't think we're going to have the right democracy that we went out for.
A book is in the works of In the Shadow of the Pyramids. When and how and where is that happening?
The book is going to come out in early 2015. It was designed by Sib, who's an award-winning Dutch designer, and I feel like he really brought my vision and the emotion, actually, that I wanted to express to the book. And it's being published by Dowie Lewis, and hopefully it will go to print end of this year, come out early 2015.
Given what you were saying a few minutes ago about how you feel like that the story is kind of complete for you, do you feel at this point that this book and the exhibition is, do you feel it's for the outside world or do you feel it's for Egypt? Who are you trying to tell the story to at this point?
I would definitely like it to appeal more to people in Egypt, but I don't know if people are going to see what I see with what I'm trying to say with the work. Because obviously, like I said, it's very political and very opinion, which I'm up to. I think people can see the work and bring whatever they want to bring to it. But I think because of where I live and because of where my network extends, you know, with my work, it tends to go more to the West. But I definitely want it to go to Egypt as well.
The work can be seen at Oxford's Pitt Museum and the Tampere Art Museum in Finland in September and Noorderlicht Photo Festival in Holland in November, or at the website intheshadowofthepyramids.com. Laura El-Tantawi, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Time now for a little light reading. Brand new fiction, hard-hitting biography, or perhaps a classic that has stayed dusty on the shelf since you pretended to read it at school. We've asked some of our regular Midori House friends, people whose taste, of course, we trust totally, to offer up their reading suggestions for the summer. First, we hear from the London-based journalist Samira Shackle, and then from the former British Shard Affair and Monocle Daily paper reviewing regular in Pyongyang, Jim Hoare.
I am Samira Shackle, and my recommended reading for the summer, first of all, is the first volume of Karl Ove Nausgaard's My Struggle, which is a 6-volume work sort of relating his entire life. He's a Norwegian writer. The first volume is called A Death in the Family, and it's all about his relationship with his father, and it's really, really fascinating. It's been sort of hailed as a masterpiece in every country that it's been translated into, so that's really, really worth reading, although maybe not the lightest book. On that note, another book that I read recently and really enjoyed was Adele Waldman's book, which is called The Love Affairs of Nathaniel P, and that's all about a young man in Brooklyn and his sort of romantic life, but it's very, very intelligently written, very readable, and sort of looks at romantic relationships in quite a serious way, but it's also sort of very amusing to read.
I'm Jim Hoare, and in our house, our summer reading is always very solemn stuff, but this year we will certainly be taking something to do with the First World War, possibly the Guardian collection When the Lamps Went Out. We go to northern France, where we have a house. But in addition, I propose to take 2 thrillers with me. One is called The Defections, and it's by a young writer, Hannah Michel, published by Kirkus Books. I know Hannah Michel. I've known her since she was a baby, and I lent her some of the books on which she bases this novel, which is about spies in South Korea. So it involves British intelligence agents, beautiful Korean women, and North Koreans. A heady mixture. The other one is also a spy story. It's, again, by somebody I know, Adam Brooks, who used to be the BBC correspondent in China, who has decided he wants to be a novelist and has written a novel about spies in China, again, involving the British Embassy and involving the whole question of the Chinese state and what it does to people. Now, those two are quite different from what we normally read, and I think we'll enjoy them.
And that was Jim Hoare and Samira Shackle on their summer reading selections. You'll hear more on the books Monocle's contributors are reading this summer on Monday's edition of Midori House here on Monocle 24.
We'll be right back.
And you are back with Midori House coming up for 1850 here in London, coming up indeed to the end of the show, which means it's time now to take a look at the best, occasionally the worst, sometimes the in-between in some or other aspect of the arts. Today we're talking film. We're joined once again by the Daily Telegraph's film critic, Tim Robey. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Cheers.
An interesting selection this evening. I wanted to start with 2 Days, One Night, the new Dardenne Brothers film. I had a certain amount of difficulty seeing past what struck me as a somewhat absurd premise.
It's a bit schematic. It's a little bit like 12 Angry Men or something, one of those films where everyone has to be converted to the sort of impeccable liberal point of view by one character. In this case, Marion Cotillard's character, who faces sacking from her job unless she can persuade about a dozen of her colleagues to basically relinquish a bonus.
See, that's where I thought this would be a short film. It's like Marion Cotillard asks people if they will do something nice for her, and they will go, yeah, sure.
She is, and she is just wonderful in it. Yeah, and it's amazing that anyone puts up a fight at all in some ways.
But if you can see past that somewhat preposterous setup, where are they going with this?
Well, they're looking at everyone's individual economic situation. So there are a lot of these other workers and families who are really hard off, and they need that 1,000 euros they've been promised. They need it for school fees and things like that. So she's basically asking for them to sacrifice money for themselves just to allow her to have a job. But she's also a depressive person. She kind of runs the risk of self-harm. There are all kinds of other problems going on with her. So she's not just a perfect kind of packaged example of a kind of liberal crusader. She's actually quite a kind of messy character in her own right.
And though I believe it is spoken and acted in the original Belgian, we do have a clip of it.
Excusez-moi de vous demander ça, mais pour moi c'est important de le voir parce qu'il peut m'aider à pas perdre mon travail, à pas aller au chômage.
La prime, nous, c'est parce qu'on a bossé qu'on l'a.
Mais je sais.
T'as pas honte, franchement, de venir nous piquer notre fric. Non, je la ferme pas, dégage.
Il y en a déjà combien qui acceptent de perdre la prime?
That from the Dardenne Brothers, 2 Days, One Night. Basically, did you like it? Is this worth seeing?
I do like it, and I definitely think it's worth seeing. I think it's been maybe slightly overpraised as a film. I thought her performance was sort of spectacular, and pretty much everything rides on her. I think the film lacks a little bit of conflict with the kind of corporate argument on the other side. There's a kind of boss, there's a foreman who, all the way through the film, we think is going to be her nemesis, and they have a kind of encounter at the end, which is over and done with within a minute. And you actually want more of that. You want kind of a bit more of the system coming into play instead of just her dealing with all of her sort of eventually quite nice colleagues. So it's slightly lacking in dramatic conflict from that point of view. I still think it's really good. It's one of the Dardenne brothers' better films, and better than the previous one, Kid with a Bike, I think.
Okay, well, let's move along then to a slightly more mainstream offering. Again, with the high concept here, this is Lucy, starring Scarlett Johansson as ass-kicking, name-taking superhero type. Kind of a somewhat preposterous setup one needs to see past or over, but explain it to
us. The setup is actually the most fun part of the film in some ways, because she begins as just this ordinary girl who's been duped into doing a muling job. She has drugs put inside her, and she's kind of packed onto a plane. And at the other end, something goes wrong, and basically these drugs seep out. And it's some new substance that hasn't even got onto the market yet, which basically allows her synapses to function at way greater than human kind of potential. So you see her beginning to kind of like just fire on all cylinders, essentially. And as she uses more and more of her brain, we get kind of arguments from Morgan Freeman in the lecture theatre about what would happen if a human being actually used 40% of his or her brain, or even 60%, and goodness knows what would happen if we used 100% of our brain.
Does Morgan Freeman play a sort of wise sage-like eminence?
He's the wise sage-like eminence.
A stretch for him.
Much like the one he played in Chain Reaction, you could say, but a little less wicked. I know, not much of a stretch, but there's something really fun about the early stretches of this film. It's bonkers, and there's a kind of Tarantino-esque element to it. It's quite violent. She's at the mercy of Korean gangsters. And then it kind of paints itself into a corner slightly, because as she gets more and more advanced and reaches towards 100%, where can the film really go other than just sort of everywhere? You know, it's like she becomes sort of all-powerful, essentially.
We have a clip from Lucy. It goes a bit like this.
You speak English?
No.
You speak English?
Yes.
Take me to the hospital now.
Hospital.
Somebody put a bag of drugs inside me. I need you to take it out. It's leaking.
It is estimated most human beings only use 10% of the brain's capacity. Imagine if we could access 100%. Interesting things begin to happen. Yes?
Professor Norman, my name's Lucy. I just read all your research on the human brain. It's a little rudimentary, but you're on the right track.
Thank you.
From Lucy there. On balance, is this worth our tenor?
I would say yes, it is, actually, because it's one of the weirder blockbusters of the summer. It's like, who expected this film to come along? It's bonkers, and it kind of overplays its hand in a way, but it's like easily Luc Besson's best film in like 20 years. I mean, you're going back to, I don't know what people think of The Fifth Element these days, but you're going back to at least that before you had a decent Luc Besson film. So I think, yeah, go for this one. It's strange, it's a bit of an acquired taste, but it has real pizzazz and style, certainly up front.
Okay, well, we'll move along finally to Night Moves, which in another stroke of audacious casting features Jesse Eisenberg as a humorless driven zealot. In this case, he wants to blow up a dam.
He does, and he's an increasingly kind of sociopathic zealot as well. He wants to blow up a dam, as do Dakota Fanning, who is a sort of slightly out of her depth radical environmentalist, and Peter Sarsgaard, who's a little bit more seasoned. The three of them hatch a plan to blow up this dam, which is going to kind of cause...
This is going to help the environment how?
This is going to help the environment by obliterating a kind of water company's assets, I think. It's going to be difficult for me, in fact, to kind of remember the details of their plan, partly because the film doesn't really tell you much about the details of their plan. It just kind of plonks you in the middle. It's a kind of nocturnal mission. They take these explosives out, which they've managed to buy from a farmer's market, and concoct together. They're going to blow this thing up. Inevitably, something goes wrong.
Okay, we have a clip of that as well.
2048, the oceans are going to be empty. How deep is this anyway?
200 feet. God knows that dam wants to come down.
We all should know what we're dealing with
here.
How
could you please shut up?
Howdy. How you guys doing today?
I thought you said no one would be here.
That from Night Moves, obviously not to be confused with the Bob Seger album of the same name, the third choice of our guest film critic, Tim Robey. Does it appear to have a point, or is it just about a pair of angry greenies threatening to blow up a dam?
It does have a point, but it's about revealing the kind of character of these people gradually as they're put under stress. So it's the kind of interesting three-way dynamic between those three characters. And despite their ideals, they push things too far, and it becomes a huge problem. And within the community they're kind of operating in, the environmental community, they become kind of pariahs. So it's about the fault lines within a movement like that and how kind of extremism can kind of tip you into madness, basically. I liked it. I like it, I think, more than a lot of this director's films, Kelly Reichardt, because it does have a bit more narrative oomph to it as it goes along. The characters are set against each other in a way that I found interesting.
Night Moves, then, the third and final selection of today's guest film critic, Tim Robey. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our earlier special guests, Tim Marshall and George Brock. Today's show was produced by Thomas Lewis, research by David Pleasant and Aaron Duffy. Our studio manager was Sean Malervy. Up after the headlines at 1900, Marcus Hippie is here with the menu. At 2200 hours, Guy Delaney and Emma Nelson will be here for the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. But for this edition, and from me, Andrew Muller, have a good weekend. Goodbye. Thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.